Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is Brian Lehrer's Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Monday, June 15th. I'm Bridget Bergen, City Hall and Politics reporter, filling in for Brian today. The death of George Floyd has reignited a fierce debate over whether monuments to the Confederacy should be allowed to stand here in New York City and around the country, too. The movement has even resonated internationally, where countries like Britain are toppling monuments to slave traders. And joining me now to discuss this local, national, and global issue are Leisha Brooks, Outreach Director at the Southern Poverty Law Center, and Gurminder Bhambra, Professor of Postcolonial Studies at the University of Sussex. Welcome to WNYC, Leisha and Professor Bhambra.
Thank you.
Good morning. Thank you.
Leisha, usually when we think of places named after General Robert E. Lee, the commander of the Confederate States Army, we think of that history belonging in the South. But there's an avenue in Brooklyn named after him that Mayor de Blasio and other local lawmakers are trying to rename. New York was strongly abolitionist during the Civil War. Why would there be anything named after Robert E. Lee here?
Great question. The Southern Poverty Law Center's research really shows that these symbols to the Confederacy and Confederate iconography are really littered all across the United States. Despite winning the Civil War, the North, the symbols were erected across the country as a way to appease the Union soldiers. It was also meant to be a step towards reconciliation between the North and the South, and that's why you find these monuments across the country.
In 2017, after a white nationalist rally in Charlottesville, Virginia turned deadly, many places around the country took down plaques and statues that represented the Confederacy, both in the North and the South. White supremacy in this country is so deep-rooted and pervasive. Why do you think the protests began with statue removal?
Well, to be clear, the protests really began after we were exposed to that 8-minute, 46-second video of Mr. Floyd being lynched in public by a police officer. It really confirmed what most Black Americans already know, that our lives are not valued. So the statue removal was more of a consequence of these protests. Ever since the Charleston massacre, activists have been actively involved and engaged in removing these symbols of white supremacy all across the country. The murder of Mr. Floyd raised more awareness about these symbols, and I believe that people began to make the connection to what are the foundations, what are the structures, what's the infrastructure of white supremacist culture. And certainly these symbols to the Confederacy are just that.
This past week, we have seen footage in the news of protesters toppling statues in Montgomery, Alabama, Nashville, Tennessee, Richmond, Virginia, as well as St. Paul, Minnesota, and Boston. The protests in the last 2 weeks have been in response to, as you were talking about, police brutality toward Black Americans. Can you talk a little bit more about how the Confederacy connects with issues of police brutality today?
That's a really excellent question as well. We can look to our history. The history of enslavement of African Americans really began the governmental control of Black bodies. The dehumanization that took place during enslavement, post-emancipation, into the Jim Crow era has always been a time where law enforcement and the government sought to control Black bodies. So the way that the culture of law enforcement today can really be traced back to that beginning, where it was established that there was white supremacy and then subjugated Black lives. And Black lives have never been valued and always deemed as dangerous and people that needed to be controlled, in particular Black men. So it really is something that is present throughout our history. We should not be surprised by what we have today, because it's based on that historical precedent.
Professor Bhambra, I want to bring you into this conversation. You wrote recently in a New York Times op-ed about the tens of thousands of people protesting in British cities in solidarity with the protests here in the States. For listeners who aren't familiar, can you paint a picture of what that looked like?
Well, it's been quite extraordinary. Over the past couple of weeks, there have been protests in almost all major cities across Britain in support of the Black Lives Matter movement in the US. And one of the things that people have done is also connected the outrage that's been felt at the killing of George Floyd with the longer histories of empire, colonization and enslavement that are also part of the history of Britain, but have never been reckoned with. And one of the most visible manifestations of that just last weekend was the taking down of the statue to Edward Colston, who had been a slave trader, had been deputy governor of the Royal African Company, and who had shipped around 100,000 enslaved people from West Africa to the Americas. His statue had been put up at the end of the 18th century in Bristol, and there had been petitions, there had been letters, there's been engagements with local authority to change the inscription on the statue, to provide more contextualization to the statue, to talk about who this man had been. And all of these had been ignored and denied, such that eventually last weekend, people decided to take matters into their own hands and not only remove the statue, but dump it into the harbor.
And what was the significance of dumping it into the harbor? There was sort of an extra disposal of it?
Well, it was partly that the harbor, those docks had been the docks from where his ships had sailed off to the Americas, or, you know, to the west coast of Africa and then to the Americas. And so there was a certain sort of symmetry to the dumping of him into that very harbor.
It's interesting. I want to bring some of our callers into this conversation. Aaron from Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Welcome
to
this
conversation. Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. I'm an immigrant from also from England, from London, and I've been hearing I think in England, as your guest said, there's been a long history of like-minded cause with racial injustice. I think partly that came from a love of Black American music, certainly my generation, the 60s, 70s, 80s. And there was similar social movements going on. So there was been movements in the 80s too of pre-Nelson Mandela and end racism. And this has been a theme. These have been social movements which have camaraderie. And I think one of the things which I find strangest is coming here is finding a lot of Americans think that America is a white country, whereas when you growing up outside of America, it's clearly not a white country in any sense. I mean, when we're little children, with lots of terrible overtones, I'm sure, but we played cowboys and Indians. It was not white people, and as we learned about Abraham Lincoln, we certainly learned about Martin Luther King, and we listened to Elvis Presley, enjoyed those movies, but to be honest, we enjoy Michael Jackson more, and on this was, even to the point of watching shows. I'm in the era of, when I was a kid, Hill Street Blues and Chips, Starsky and Hutch, and they look so different from the world I lived in. I mean, they're Black people, Hispanic people, Latin people, the names, as they scrolled out, Kronkos and Begovich's side, it wasn't Smith Jr., Birtwistle, Harrison, Major. It was a completely different world. And so I think America is the melting pot it wants to be. It just has to grow up and kind of get on with it. And white people here have to stop having a self-awareness, I guess. I'd say as someone who loves this country, moved here voluntarily, grew up with some white Americans in my household, I would plead with white Americans to kind of look at, and all white people myself, all of us, to look at our role in making this false construct, but it's a white country,
Aaron,
it's a white world. It isn't.
Aaron, thank you so much for calling and for your point of view. I'd love to get some reaction from both of you, Leisha and Professor Bambara, to Aaron's notion that the idea of America looks different across the country, but that we really are a melting pot. What are your thoughts on that?
Professor, why don't you take a first at your countrymen?
Okay. I mean, one of the things that I find quite interesting is the way in which there's often, from Britain particularly, we often look to the US to think about the way in which racial politics, for example, are configured and played out. And that same reflective gaze isn't taken back upon ourselves to think also about the histories of empire and colonization that have also constructed Britain. So I think one of the things that I find interesting is that Britain often takes its lead from the US, and we can see in relation to these protests, you know, they were sparked by the killing of George Floyd, and they were certainly then used as the basis of thinking about similar sorts of killings that have happened within the UK, deaths as a consequence of police brutality here. But I find it interesting that those deaths that happened here didn't spark the same level of protests, although people are making the links at the moment. So I guess I would want to take the questioner's point of view slightly differently and say that whilst in Britain we're very aware of the racial politics of the US, and certainly that's something that we often grapple with, we're less aware of the differently constructed racial histories that make up the UK. And we also need to look at the ways in which those histories of imperialism and enslavement have made Britain possible. And that's one of the things that I was trying to get across in that piece that I wrote last weekend, about thinking about how these histories are very much a part of British history as well, and we need to reckon with that.
Thank you for and that. The history.
Go ahead,
I just
Lisa.
Say a bit?
Yes, please.
Yeah, the history of white supremacy, unfortunately, is present, you know, across the globe. As a person, as an African-American woman who, you know, travels pretty extensively, I can tell you that I'm a Black woman wherever I go. And I've had an opportunity to engage with Black Lives Matter protesters across the EU. The racism that we experience here is experienced similarly by Black people, members of the African diaspora across the globe. So when Brian talks about kind of what, you know, the contributions of African Americans to the U.S. in terms of culture, I wish it were more than that. Mm-hmm. That we need to be viewed as full human beings. That we eliminate or erase any signs of racial hierarchy, because unless until we do that, we won't come together. It's not about understanding or accepting or appreciating, you know, different people's culture. And we most certainly are not a melting pot. There's no way that we can be a melting pot the way this country was constructed on race, right? Mm-hmm. So
you're listening to The Brian Lehrer Show. I'm Bridget Bergen, a reporter in the WNYC and Gothamist newsroom. If you're just joining us, we are talking about the national and global movement to remove symbols of white supremacy with Lisha Brooks, Outreach Director at the Southern Poverty Law Center, and Professor Gurminder Bhambra, Professor of Postcolonial Studies at the University of Sussex. Lisha, here in the States, historians point out that many of the Confederate statues weren't actually put in place until after the Civil War. They came during the Jim Crow era. Can you help contextualize what they represented then?
Thank you for that. Actually, the first peak in the erection of these monuments really came at the beginning of Reconstruction, kind of right before Jim Crow laws were being set into place, when the former Confederate states were writing their constitutions. So they were erected to intimidate African Americans and to remind us that white supremacy really was the law of the land. So we saw that peak then. And then we saw another peak in the construction of these monuments during the Civil Rights Movement in the 50s and 60s. So it's clear that these monuments continue to be erected at times when African Americans have fought for full civil and human rights. That's the context. They have nothing to do. It's not a heritage. It's not a heritage, not hate kind of argument. That it's a proven fact that why they were erected, to intimidate African Americans and to assert white supremacy in this country.
Mm. Let's bring another caller into this conversation. Rob from Seattle, Washington, you're on WNYC. Welcome. And what are your thoughts on the Confederate monuments?
Well, as a 20-year military veteran, the conversation now amongst me and my friends a lot, especially on social media, is about the renaming of military bases that are named for Confederate leaders. And, you know, I seem to be kind of on one side of the argument, and everybody else seems to be on the other, that, you know, what difference does it make? You know, Fort Bragg and Fort Benning have always been Fort Bragg and Fort Benning. But for me, it just seems preposterous to have named bases for to honor the losing side of a war. There's no Camp Hitler and there's no Fort Rommel in Europe. So why is it still okay for us as the United States Army, who were the victors, to have named things after the loser? So for me, I think it's beyond time to go ahead and rename it Fort whatever, Fort Southwest Georgia or whatever, you know.
Rob, thank you so much for calling WNYC. Thanks for listening and thanks for your service. Alicia, what are your thoughts on Rob's point of view?
Well, first of all, Rob, I really appreciate you. Thank you so much. My son was stationed at Fort Bragg. And for your listeners, just a little context, there are 10 military bases that are currently named after former Confederate leaders, right? And one questionable Navy vessel. But the naming of military assets after Confederate generals really occurred after the Confederate Army surrendered, right? And so, to Rob's point, they were the losing side. They took up arms against the United States, treasonous actors, if you will. But the Southern Poverty Law Center is just thrilled that the U.S. Senate Armed Services Committee last week adopted an amendment that will allow the Pentagon to remove the names of these Confederate generals from our military assets. And those assets include bases and installations and aircraft and ships within the next 3 years. And we want to commend them for their bold step against President Trump's tweet that they would not be changed. And because, you know, great heroes and great things, and I forget what he tweeted out, happened at these bases. But to Rob's point, he's absolutely right. Why should our military personnel be connected to Confederate leaders? And to be clear, Confederate leaders fought to continue the enslavement of human beings. They fought to continue the enslavement of African Americans. And we do well not to miss that point and not to remember that point.
I want to bring in one more caller, Alex in Brooklyn, who I think is originally from Richmond, Virginia. Alex, welcome to WNYC.
Hey, thank you for having me. Yeah, so I grew up in Richmond, Virginia. I've lived in New York for about 10 years now. But I've been very excited to see all like the progress Richmond is making on Monument Avenue right now. And I know, like, personally, like, people in my life who, like, initially thought, would have said, oh, let's add contextual plaques or something like this that are now, like, very, like, for their removal. So it's, like, it's mm-hmm. exciting to see, I feel like. Mm-hmm. And what your guest was just saying, too, about the Confederate generals seeking to, like, working, like, fighting for slavery. I mean, I think that's like such an important thing that sounds like so obvious if you grow up not in Virginia, but if you go to public schools in Virginia, you're really taught, like, I mean, I don't know what they're doing now, but they really try to hammer in that it was the Civil War wasn't about slavery when it just like blatantly was. So
Alex, thank you so much for calling and for sharing that perspective that you're hearing from some of your friends and family back home in Richmond, Virginia. I want to bring Professor Bombra back into the conversation. Professor, you write about how the resurgence of Black Lives Matter, the resurgence of the Black Lives Matter movement is happening in light of the disproportionate deaths of Black, Asian, and other minority ethnic groups in Britain, mostly people with origins in the former colonies, from COVID-19. Can you tell us more about that and how it ties into systemic racial inequality?
Well, one of the things that's happened over the last few weeks in relation to COVID-19 is precisely that there have been more deaths, disproportionately more deaths from these communities than from the majority population. And in the research that started to happen in terms of thinking about how and why these deaths are happening more in these communities, the key issue that has constantly come up is that it's issues related with systemic racism, with deprivation, and with socioeconomic issues. So there's nothing genetic about it. There's nothing about the underlying conditions, you know, different sorts of explanations that have been presented by people. But the key issue really is that their place within society here in Britain is still related to the fact that they come from the former colonies, and those hierarchies continue to be replicated and reproduced within contemporary society. And one of the things that's been interesting is the fact that a number of these people have also worked for the NHS. They've been key workers, bus drivers, porters, other people, and their faces are being shown on national TV. And people are beginning to see that actually these people also make up our society. And yet look at what's going on in terms of the disproportionate numbers of deaths in these populations. So I think when the killing of George Floyd was came to be known about here, and it coincided with the disproportionate deaths that were happening amongst Black, Asian and minority ethnic communities, that these things coalesced in a way to really give rise to this sense of injustice that's happening across countries, and people wanted to make a stand against those sorts of inequalities and to say that we can be better than this.
Leisha, I want to ask you about another troubling thing that has happened last week. A 24-year-old man named Robert Fuller was found hanging from a tree in Palmdale, California, near the City Hall building. The local police department has ruled it a suicide, but the Attorney General for California is expected to conduct an independent investigation. This is the second Black man in 2 weeks to be found hanging in that area. Has the Southern Poverty Law Center released an official statement about these two cases?
No. First, let me offer my condolences to the Fuller family. And the Southern Poverty Law Center is researching that tragic death. I would say that Mr. Fuller's supposed suicide is not the first, right? Over the last few years, we've had a number of hangings, lynchings that have been identified by authorities as suicide. So that's another thing that we're looking into. There's just so much tragedy with respect to Black lives, which is why the Black Lives Matter movement continues. And if I could just say that when you characterize Black Lives Matter movement as a resurgence, I just want to make clear that the movement has been present in communities, you know, throughout, and
absolutely.
And that is one of the reasons why they're able to show up and galvanize such support today, because they've been on the street, they've been a part of organizing kind of throughout the news cycle.
Absolutely, and thank you for adding that note. We're going to have to leave it there for today. My guests have been Leisha Brooks, Outreach Director at the Southern Poverty Law Center, and Professor Graminda Bambara, Professor of Postcolonial Studies at the University of Sussex. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you, Bridget. Thank you, Professor.
Brian Lehrer, a daily politics podcast, is obviously also a daily coronavirus podcast under the circumstances in our country right now. We'll keep staying on top of things to serve you the best we can. And remember, this podcast is excerpted from my live weekday call-in show, The Brian Lehrer Show. If you want to be a caller or just hear it live, it's from 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time on WNYC Radio in New York, or online at WNYC.org. You can also tweet a question at us anytime. Just tweet at Brian Lehrer. Thanks for listening today.